So tonight is the closing of a short trip through the Gospel of Mark. And yes, tonight could also be an opportunity to talk about Elijah, and I have chosen not to. At some point, we'll talk about Elijah in the future. Even though it was a short trip, I feel like we've covered quite a bit of ground. But even though we've covered quite a bit of ground, we're not going to make it to Jerusalem. Not because we ran out of gas, as if our car didn't have enough gas to make it to Jerusalem. But there's something important about leaving Jesus outside of Jerusalem as we enter this time of Lent. We're going to, leave it right there. Because entering Jerusalem, this only happens for Jesus at the beginning of the Passion Week with Palm Sunday in the Gospel of Mark, when Jesus is hailed as King. In the Gospel of Mark, Jesus seems to be preaching here, there, and everywhere, all throughout the region of ancient Palestine. But Mark leaves him outside of Jerusalem until the Passion Week starts, until he enters in the triumphal entry. So I thought it was fitting to kind of follow Mark's cues and leave us just before entering Jerusalem in our short study of Mark between Epiphany and Lent. Jesus has been announcing the kingdom gospel. He's been announcing the fact that the kingdom is arriving in him. But it's an important shift that happens when he enters Jerusalem, and we'll be looking at some of those aspects over the next little while. Jerusalem, for Jesus and for Mark, is the geographical and theological goal of the narrative. Everything centers around this city, the city where God chose to let his presence dwell, where the temple was built, that city of David. Everything centers there, but it doesn't end there. It doesn't end in his death. It moves out from Jerusalem in his resurrection to all the corners of the earth. The path to Jerusalem is the pathway of the Messiah. It's his journey to death. It's the place that he will die, but it's also the place where he will rise again, where new creation then begins, the place from which the disciples are sent out, proclaiming all they have learned, all they have come to now understand after Pentecost, after the Spirit is given to them as they journey to all the corners of the earth. Of course, as we highlighted last week, and the disciples don't always see well, and this was a big theme when we talked about Peter's correct identification of Jesus as Lord, or as Christ last week, but that he didn't quite have the eyes to see or the ears to hear, to understand what that term Christ really meant. He gets it wrong because he doesn't yet understand what it means for Jesus to be the Christ, what it means for Jesus to enter Jerusalem and to give his life, what it means, as is written in Mark 10:45, that even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others and give his life as a ransom for many. Last week I made a short tangential statement about the blind healing episodes in the Gospel of Mark and how they form a sort of bookends around this, Peter's confession and Jesus moving towards Jerusalem. And today I'd like to actually engage and discuss them a little bit to make sense of that kind of offhanded comment that I made. It's on page 1533, so if you have your Bibles open from last week, it's right there, just previous to it. And so we'll read chapter 8, 22 to 26, and then we'll flip over a couple pages to chapter 11 and read 46 to 52. And these are the two blind healings, and we're going to discuss how they're similar, how they're different, and how they speak into our lives. So let us read this together. When they arrived at Bethsaida, some people brought a blind man to Jesus, and they begged him to touch the man and heal him. Jesus took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village. Then, spitting on the man's eyes, he laid his hands on him and asked, "Can you see anything now?" The man looked around. "Yes," he said, "I see people, but I can't see them very clearly. They look like trees walking around." Then Jesus placed his hands on the man's eyes again, and his eyes were opened. His sight was completely restored, and he could see everything clearly. Jesus sent him away, saying, "Don't go back into the village on your way home." So then flipping over to Mark 11. Sorry, it should say Mark 10. That's a typo on my PowerPoint. But it's nevertheless at the top of page 1539. Then they reached Jericho. And as Jesus and his disciples left town, a large crowd followed him. A blind beggar named Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus, was sitting beside the road. When Bartimaeus heard that Jesus of Nazareth was nearby, he began to shout, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." "Be quiet," many of the people yelled at him. But he only shouted louder, "Son of David, have mercy on me." When Jesus heard him, he stopped and said, "Tell him to come here." So they called the blind man. "Cheer up," they said. "Come on, he's calling you." Bartimaeus threw aside his coat, jumped up, and came to Jesus. "What do you want to do? What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked. "My rabbi," the blind man said, "I want to see." And Jesus said to him, "Go, for your faith has healed you." Instantly, the man could see, and he followed Jesus down the road. The first blind healing actually has a lot in common with the deaf and mute healing. Just a few chapters earlier, in chapter 7, verses 31 to 37. And many commentators join these passages together in how they deal with it. Both of these healings, the one with the blind man and the deaf man from chapter 7, happen in the northern regions of Israel. Both happen at times when Jesus is requested to heal the man, as opposed to the man asking himself to be healed. Both times, Jesus leads the man away from the city. So there's a certain conceptual and linguistic overlap between these two passages that deal with ears to hear and eyes to see. And many see this in the background of Isaiah 35, verse 5. And it's a passage that celebrates and is rejoicing for the time when Yahweh will again visit his people. And the celebration is given, "Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall hear." This is the celebration of the time when Yahweh will visit his people, when healings will happen. People have ears to hear and eyes to see. This stands in contrast in the background of Isaiah 6 as well. And this is the passage where Isaiah is being sent as a prophet to the people of Israel. He's being sent, but with the warning that people will not necessarily respond to his message. He's supposed to proclaim the message of the Lord's coming. This is good news that he's supposed to proclaim. And the Lord purifies his lips, the prophet Isaiah, as he's announced this message of good news. And Isaiah 6, 9 to 10 reads just like this. And he said, "Go and say to this people, you will listen by listening, but you will not understand. And looking, you will look, but you will not perceive. This people will not have ears to hear or eyes to see." And this is the warning that's given to Isaiah as he goes and prophesies the good news of Yahweh coming. And this kind of mirrors the situation that Jesus finds as he travels around Israel. Mirrors the not hearing and not seeing of the people of Israel as they don't listen to his message, to the kingdom announcement of good news. The kingdom that Yahweh is arriving in him, in their midst. That the time of Isaiah 35 is upon them, that healings are taking place. It's time to rejoice. But so often the crowd, the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, and even disciples are deaf and blind to it. They either oppose to this gospel proclamation or they seem confused by what the gospel truly means. So the first blind healing happens in Bethsaida, which is in the north of Jerusalem. And this is just a little south of where Peter makes his declaration from the message last week. And there's a couple of things of interest. The man himself actually doesn't request Jesus to act. He also isn't named in the text. We don't know what his name is, which is common in the Gospel of Mark, but which sets it in a bit of contrast with the passage we'll look at in a second. This man does speak, but he only speaks when he's spoken to. People have to bring him to Jesus. They have to encourage him to go. The request to be touched by Jesus doesn't come from him. It comes from the people who bring him there. And it's not actually in this text a request for healing. It's not explicitly stated that the people who bring him there are asking for Jesus to heal him. We infer that as readers about what it means to be touched by Jesus. We assume that being touched by Jesus then means the healing will take place. And we think about this in the context of the unnamed woman that we looked at back a few weeks ago. She just reaches out, just touches the cloak barely, and then is healed because of it. And so we infer that this would mean healing, thinking back to that story. And what's interesting in this blind man's story is that Jesus touches this guy quite a bit, but he's not immediately healed. Mark describes the process of the man being led out, being taken by the hand, with Jesus, but he's not immediately healed, even as Jesus takes his hand. And Mark continues to describe this process, and it seems a little bit odd that Jesus spits directly in his eyes. That seems to me to be way too much touching. Even for people who have physical touch as one of their language, I would imagine that this is a little bit too much touching to have somebody spit in your eyes. But Jesus asked this blind man, after spitting in his eyes, if he sees anything. Has the healing taken place? And the answer is that it hasn't completely taken place. He's able to see a little bit. He's able to see something. But all he can see is what looks like people walking around like trees. The healing will need a second touch. Some people believe that this, how he describes the trees and what trees look like, means that this man went gradually blind over a course of time, and that now his sight is being restored to him again. Nevertheless, Jesus, in this moment, he takes his hands, he puts them on the man's eyes. He is then healed. He's able to see. He's able to see clearly. His eyes are open. He is restored. He's able to see. And Jesus sends him back, not directly to his village, but beyond that, to where he place where he resides. The second blind healing takes place at Jericho, and Jericho is not very far from Jerusalem, just a little bit outside. And we get far, far more description about this blind man. First, he gets a name, which is uncommon in the Gospel of Mark, that those who are healed get a specific name. We had that with Jairus in the same story of the healing of the unnamed woman and the healing of Jairus's daughter. And so it's uncommon for characters to get names. But Bartimaeus actually receives even more than a name. He receives a family name. He's further characterized as the son of Timaeus. And perhaps this addition of names, this piling on of names, this fuller characterization of the story, helps us to see that what's important is not Bartimaeus' name or the fact that he is son of Timaeus, but it's the name that he calls Jesus when he cries out for mercy. In the Gospel of Mark, this is the first time that Jesus is called the Son of David. But before we get there, we get a few little more characterizations of who this blind man is. He's a blind beggar who is sitting by the roadside. He's a very round character. We get a full, clear picture. We're able to see him quite clearly in comparison with many of the other biblical characters. And as he sits there, he has ears to hear that it is Jesus of Nazareth who's walking by. And because of this, he responds, he calls out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." Son of David, being a royal term, comes out of the lips of Bartimaeus just as Jesus is about to enter Jerusalem, the city of where David resided as king, the city that he established. The Messiah was always expected to sit and rule on David's throne, to establish his rule and his kingdom. So Mark here, and through the lips of Bartimaeus, is preparing us for this so-called triumphal entry, which is about to happen, where people celebrate the arrival of the Christ as the Son of David as he enters Jerusalem. But just like Peter, people are going to have a fuller picture of what it means for Jesus to be the Christ, to be the Son of David, as he enters Jerusalem. The second thing that's interesting about Bartimaeus is that he has ears to hear, but he does not yet have eyes to see. But in this, he has a request for mercy. Have mercy on me. And this is the correct posture of a person who needs healing, a person who is suffering, a person who is in need, a person who is being prepared to meet Jesus the King, to have him take on their struggles, their pain, their sufferings, the thing that keeps them hurting, the thing that keeps them in an undignified position. It's the correct opportunity, the correct posture to call out for mercy. And this, by contrast, is sadly what Jesus does not find as he enters Jerusalem, as he comes to his people. They do not cry out for mercy as he's celebrated as king. They celebrate the arrival of David, but they don't understand what he has come to bring and what they need from him, like Bartimaeus does. Bartimaeus, in clear contrast to the first blind man, is very active in his request for healing, in his calling out to Jesus. The first blind man needed people to bring him there, but Bartimaeus is able to respond just by healing that Jesus, just by hearing that Jesus of Nazareth is walking by. The crowd tell him to be silent, but he calls it a second time, not him at all, as he calls it louder. Jesus stops and instructs Bartimaeus to come. And the crowd speak two verbs to Bartimaeus. They tell him to be heartened and to arise. And with this, Bartimaeus springs to his feet, leaves his cloak, goes to Jesus. This is the correct posture of how one is supposed to embrace Jesus. Bartimaeus is overcome by his desire to be healed. And because of this, because of his faith, the teacher heals him and responds to him. Jesus says to him, "Go, for your faith has healed you." Immediately, right away, "Uthus" is the word that we talked about a few weeks ago, happens in this incident. It happens right away. And then he follows after Jesus. He now has both ears to hear and eyes to see, and now turns to follow Jesus. And many believe that this extends not just following Jesus into Jerusalem, but highlights that he's now become a disciple. But through his healing, through the extension of mercy that Jesus has given to him, he chooses to follow after Jesus as one who has ears to hear and eyes to see. Another aspect of Isaiah seems to come into focus as we contemplate these two healings in the second touch. And I'm drawing quite a bit on Ricky Watts, who has done quite a bit of work in this section. And he highlights how Isaiah 42 and the idea of Jesus leading disciples on a path that they do not know that they were going. And we talked about this right at the beginning, about how Jesus calls them into an extraordinary journey where they weren't prepared for beyond what they could have expected. And highlighted in the healing of the deaf and healing of the blind is that Jesus leads these people outside, and specifically the blind men who would not have known the path that he was going. Jesus takes them on that journey. The disciples are going to need two touches from Jesus to fully understand who he is as the Christ. Things that we talked about last week, that Peter understands that Jesus is the Christ, but doesn't yet understand fully what that means. He will only understand later in the resurrection. To quote from Watts and this section here, Mark's Jesus, having already restored a deaf man, chapter 7, 31-37, will now lead his blind disciples along a new Exodus way that they do not know, highlighting Isaiah 42, verse 16, which appropriately enough begins and ends with the granting of sight to the blind, Mark 8, 22-26, and Mark 10, 46-52. They are beginning to see, they are beginning to understand what it means to follow after Jesus, what it means for him to be the Christ. Peter sees correctly, but he still sees blurrily, like the man who was originally healed. It's almost like he sees Jesus as the Christ, as trees walking around. But then in the resurrection, he's able to see fully what it means for the Christ to suffer and then to be raised again. As we contemplate our situation, as we contemplate who we are, we can find ourselves in various aspects in these stories. We all need to, in our lives, to experience the healing touch of Jesus, to encounter him, to be made whole, to see correctly, to hear correctly as well, to have our eyes opened, to have our ears touched as well, to be opened. In some way, we need Jesus to take on our blindness, to take on our deafness, to take on our suffering, our struggles, the situations where we need healing, the situations that we're struggling on, for him to lead us in the path of the disciple, path of discipleship, in the way that he'd have us go. Sometimes we come like the first blind man. We come somewhat reluctantly, or we come nor at the prodding of others around us, relying on their lead, relying on their encouragement, relying on them perhaps seeing our need even more fully than we see it ourselves, perhaps hoping beyond what we could hope in that situation, encouraging us to come and to embrace the mercy and the healing of Christ, to experience his touch and his restoration. And sometimes in these circumstances, in these experiences, we're like the first blind man as well, where it takes time. It's not in the first touch of Jesus that we receive healing, that restoration happens in whatever situation we find ourselves, that our pain isn't immediately relieved, that the need remains, that we need a second touch, we need a third touch, perhaps a fourth. We need that continual touch of Jesus to bring the full restoration in our lives. That the process of being made new only begins, but it needs to be made new again and again as we continue to encounter Him. Sometimes we recognize our need for mercy and we come running to Him crying out, "Have mercy on us." We're recognizing our own blindness, recognizing the own places where we need healing and need His touch. And at times in our lives, these situations of triumph, these situations of healing, of restoration come immediately. Comes in that single touch, that single movement of the Spirit where He leaves our burdens and makes us new in what seems like an immediate moment. And then we are encouraged and restored and able to follow after Him. Whatever situation you find yourself in today, the healing touch of Jesus is there. He is ready and willing to extend His mercy, to extend His healing and touch. Perhaps, as I said, it will take time. Perhaps there will be numerous times where we need to encounter Him and need to embrace His healing. But perhaps He will heal us immediately in our situations of struggle in the moment as we encounter Him. At the table, we have an opportunity each week to come forward and to have ourselves be touched, be encouraged, to have His mercy extended to our lives. We're able to come to the table and to embrace His body and His blood and embrace what His healing is for our lives and how that encourages us to move out on the ways that we will go into the places we find ourselves, continuing on that path of mercy, the path of discipleship, the path of following after Him. It's an opportunity to request mercy and then to go out from that place following Him, being renewed continually in His Spirit on the path that we should go, with new eyes to see and new ears to hear, having been opened by Him.